I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, a hefty portion of the American people's tax dollars go directly into the defense budget, or in less prettified terms, war. A radical subset of the peace movement has responded for some time now, by refusing to pay their taxes to the Internal Revenue Service. Known as war tax resistors, these citizens are not necessarily against taxation or the IRS itself, but rather the amount of their tax dollars that would go directly into the funding of America's wars abroad. Joining us on this edition of the show to discuss war tax resistance and his own unique life story is America's number one war tax resistor, Larry Bassett. Larry was recently the subject of an award-winning independent documentary titled The Pacifist, which is now available for streaming on Amazon. And if you have Amazon Prime, you can view it right now without any extra charge. Now, as I said before, Larry's story is fairly unique. He inherited $1 million from his father. He owes over $200,000 to the IRS. And he has redirected over $200,000 into charitable causes. This is not a man who is trying to dodge the IRS for selfish reasons. In fact, as of the time the documentary was made and came out, Larry's donations to charitable organizations exceeded that of what he owed the IRS. Oh, and by the way, if you think Larry is just dodging taxes, well, get this. He files with the IRS each and every year, but Larry always ends up telling them he's not going to be giving them any money that would go towards the funding of what he sees as unjust wars. Like I said, this is a unique story, and you're going to hear all about it on this edition of Parallax Views. So now, without further ado, America's number one war tax protester, the pacifist, Larry Bassett. Welcome to Parallax Views, Larry Bassett, America's number one war tax resister, and the subject of the documentary The Pacifist, which has won multiple awards at the 2018 Independent Film Festival. Welcome to the show, Larry. How is your day today?
My day is very good, and I hope that our conversation in the next little while will give some people out there some things to think about, because I think a lot of us think about the issue that we're going to be talking about and don't know quite what to do about it personally.
Well, you know, Larry, I want to get into who you are, how you came in to be involved in sort of the peace movement. But before we do that, when we say war tax resistor, a lot of people may not know what that means. So I want to get into that. And I want to sort of, is there a difference between a war tax resistor or a war tax protester and, say, someone who's just against all taxes completely?
Well, war tax resistors come in lots of different stripes and colors. You know, it has to do with war spending, and it has to do with taxes, and it has to do with not supporting that system. So that's kind of the three words. But everybody who might be a war tax resistor doesn't use that terminology. Some people call themselves war tax redirectors. Some call themselves conscientious military tax objectors. But the bottom line is it's not necessarily against taxation. There are certainly some war tax resistors that would oppose taxation. But basically, war tax resistance is not an anti-tax issue. It's an what the taxes are used for. And although we focus a lot on the Internal Revenue Service, don't actually feel like the IRS is our enemy. They're just the mechanism by which the United States comes and knocks on our door and says, give me your money so that I can go off and kill people. And, you know, that's kind of the bottom line for a war tax resistor. It's like, so if somebody came to your door or you got a letter in the mail or somebody called you on the phone and said, I'm collecting money to kill people, would you donate? And, you know, most people wouldn't. And yet the IRS takes our money. That's what they do with a whole lot of it. And we all know that. And yet we go along with it.
Yeah, it's always struck me how people say we can't have something like, say, Medicare for All, but we spend, you know, I think it's close to or over 50% of those taxes on the defense industry, on national defense.
The federal income taxes are the part of the tax system that the Congress controls. You know, there are other taxes and there are other ways the government has money. But the federal income taxes don't have anything to do with Social Security because they get that money elsewhere. It doesn't have anything to do with Medicare because they get that money elsewhere. But it has to do with the money that the Congress allocates. And for years, for as long as I've been alive, that part of the federal income tax has been around 50%. Might go up a couple percent, might go down a couple percent. But half of the money that people pay into the federal income tax system, which for most people comes out of their paycheck, goes to the military. And of course, the military budget these days, I mean, the amount that this country spends on war and preparation for war, you know, has got to be more than $1 trillion a year. You know, people have heard of the current military budget, the current, they call it the Defense Department, $750 billion. And of course, there's more money in other budgets for nuclear weapons. And everybody's heard of the black budget or the dark budget, the mystery money that goes off to pay for anti-terrorism and all the other things that are that we're not that we don't get to know about. So, you know, there's a lot of money that goes for war and killing. And so I would have to go back and say, you know, you can't be perfect in this world. It's pretty hard, but, you know, not paying to kill somebody kind of seems basic. And, you know, we kind of scratch our heads and say, why don't more people do this? And, you know, that's the mystery in my life.
Well, Larry, I think maybe right now the listeners may find you a bit enigmatic because we haven't gotten into maybe who you are and what your upbringing was like. And I think that's an interesting story to unravel in itself. Maybe you could tell listeners a little bit about your early life and how you eventually would end up becoming a war tax resister.
Well, I grew up in a all-white Detroit suburb in southeastern Michigan, Royal Oak, Michigan. And it was just on the edge of Detroit, you know, went to high school in Royal Oak, and then I went off to college at the University of Michigan in the, in 1964. And I went from this fairly conservative town, with relatively conservative parents. My father was a business manager. He was, you know, I don't remember what they called them, but like the block captain for the Republican Party. And my mother was much more progressive than my dad was, but still, she was a housewife. And, you know, she kind of took the back seat to Pop. So I went off to Ann Arbor. And it was 1964, and they had I believe it was the first teach-in in the country at a college about Vietnam. So there I was, kind of in the maelstrom of the world changing, for me, certainly. I ended up getting married and having a child when I was in college. I also worked for the post office when I was in college, and on Saturdays I delivered the mail on the downtown Ann Arbor route, which included the Selective Service Office. So every Saturday morning I would get up early and put on my post office uniform and go down and sort out my mail, which included probably an inch or two of, I can't remember the color, I want to say blue or green, postcards that were being sent back to the Selective Service System because there was a draft. And then I would take my mail and go out and walk down the street, and the Selective Service Office was on the second floor, so I would walk up the stairs. And most Saturdays, the outside the Selective Service Office was filled with protesters. They were peaceful protesters, but mostly college students, and they were sitting on the floor, and I would have to step around them in my postal service uniform. I'm like 20. I'm the same age, and in fact, at that point I have a draft deferment because I'm a student, and you used to get a deferment if you were a college student. But there I am stepping through these people, and they were very kind to me. They knew what I was doing, and I knew what I was doing. So anyway, I'm pretty alert to all of a sudden here I am. I'm part of the system. And yet the people who were opposing that system, they weren't hostile to me. They were hostile to the system. So anyway, the process of the legality of the draft changing, they decided not to let college students be deferred. So I was 1A. There I am, 1A, And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? You know, because I was pretty sure I wasn't going to go off and shoot a gun at somebody.
But you were at the top of the list.
I was, you know, they were drawing names out of the hat, you know, drawing numbers. And there I was, you know, listening to Alice's Restaurant on the radio every Saturday night, and thinking, what am I going to do? I had a kid. And so I was still exempt, because at that point, if you had a kid, you were exempt. So I had a son when I was 20 years old, and I had a full-time job at the post office when I was 20 years old, and I was a full-time student when I was 20 years old. And so I was pretty wrapped up in just making it through the day. And I didn't have to make that decision. You know, I came to the bend in the road, and I didn't have to decide, do I go this way or that way, because I wasn't going to be drafted. But there was that period of time where, you know, I had to think about that. So a little time goes by.
Well, could I interrupt real quick?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting you said earlier, you know, when the possibility of being drafted came up, you said, you know, you thought about, like, how could I kill anyone? It's interesting because I know a lot of people that lived through Vietnam, and their concern when it came to the draft was, I don't want to be killed. And I kind of think it's telling that your first thought was, I couldn't harm anyone like that. I can't do that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Maybe it's the, you know, maybe it's that white male thing. You know, I have done a lot of things where people say, you're so brave. And I say, I don't think so. But I do feel a little like, it's not like I don't think any harm can come to me. But, you know, I don't feel threatened like that, but the idea of doing something to actually end the life of something. In the film, I tell the story of when I was a kid killing a guinea pig, a baby guinea pig that was injured. I raised guinea pigs, and you know, there was an injured guinea pig, and I thought it was gonna die, so I thought I would try to put it out of its misery, and I chloroformed it to death, basically, but I held it in my hand and did it till the thing died. And, you know, I've in making the film, I thought a lot about, because people said, so when did you think you were a pacifist? And I said, you know, I never even heard of the word, but I was thinking about, where did this come from? Where was it then that, you know, it was certainly not Alice's Restaurant, you know, Arlo Guthrie singing, but, you know, that kind of, I kind of identified with that. And I have thought about it. And, you know, this example of holding a living, I raised guinea pigs and gerbils and did all those kid things that you do when you live in the suburbs. And, you know, having things die was part of that experience. But actually killing something was pretty traumatic for me. So I don't know. It's just part of the story of my life. So later it came to me that, okay, now I'm paying taxes. And, you know, I know what the government's doing with those taxes. They're funding the war. And again, during Vietnam, the government even assisted those of us who were organizing against taxes, because they actually passed a tax on the telephone. They said, okay, we need more money. They don't pass taxes to cover war expenses in the 21st century. Nobody thinks they're paying for war, because the government never says, oh, this money is for war. But, you know, then they put like a 10% tax on the telephone service. So everybody knew that this 10%, and they talked about it when they passed it, they said, this is to help fund Vietnam. And so people said, so we will refuse to pay this 10% tax. And a lot of people did, because it was pretty safe. It didn't feel like it didn't, they didn't feel like the government was going to come after them for not paying 10%. So a lot of people did that. They felt safe doing that. And it was relatively easy. And the phone company didn't cut off their service. And it was kind of a thing. So again, you know, why don't more people do that now? And, you know, sometimes we think, well, we talk about the amount of the money that the United States spends on the military. And people say, well, you know, the amount that I pay is so small. What possible difference could that make? And, you know, of course that's true. You know, for most people, you know, if they didn't pay their whole amount that they might owe in income taxes, it wouldn't pay for one missile. So, you know, I've never thought that any general has had a short on his paycheck because I didn't pay. So taking money away from the military, I think, seems to a lot of people to say, you know, what difference could that make? And what if even 10,000 people did it? And the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, which is the national organization that promotes and assists people doing war tax resistance. We call it NUTRIC. The National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, which was formed in 1982 by a number of peace organizations, estimates that there are 10,000 war tax resistors in the country. And, you know, what difference can 10,000 people make out of a country the size of the United States? Well, you know, that's a long conversation, and we have it all the time. Think about what difference can one person make? And that's really what the pacifist is all about, what one person did. And granted that one person was in a fairly unique situation, but aren't we all? I mean, we all are in our own situation, and you do what you can. You just do what you can. And you always have to hope that it will make a difference.
Well, you know,
that's what I do.
That leads me into the next question I had for you. How do you, what's the point where you sort of become a war tax resistor? I know 1985 was a pretty pivotal year. Maybe we could delve into that a little bit.
Okay, well, let me back up a little from there, because what I have begun to believe that the resistance is always important. You have to resist evil. So the resistance is important. But for me, the benefit of war tax resistance has been the fact that for most resistors, it's not just a matter of not paying the government. It's taking that money and doing something better with it. And it's hard not to do something better with it than killing people. You know, that's a pretty black and white situation. But the better that I did, you can do with even just a little bit of money. So my first resistance back in the 1970s was about $300. And that's not very much money, but the story of that is just shows how positive even a small amount can be, because I lived in a small southern town and there was a summer feeding program and they had the food for poor kids because they had government surplus food for free, but they didn't have money to buy, you know, plates, plastic, paper plates and forks and things to actually serve the food. So they weren't going to be able to have the program. But I had $300 and I gave them $300. So the program happened. And I thought, wow, you know, so even the $300 in that case made a difference. But the thing that amazed me was that after I did that, I was at a meeting, and I can't even remember what the meeting was, but it was in Blacksburg, Virginia. And the Blacksburg is where Virginia Tech is. So Blacksburg is kind of a college town. So I was at this meeting in this big room with people sitting around, and I got to stand up and tell my story of redirecting this $300. And after I told the story, which only took a couple of minutes, I wasn't quite as glib as I am now. I tell the story now better than I did probably back in 1970, whatever it was. And people applauded. And I thought, wow, you know, that was kind of like, you know, it's always nice to get a pat on the back. And people seem to be impressed. So I'm not paying small amounts of taxes. But a few years later, I'm working for working for NUTRIC, the organization that I mentioned before, the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. I'm working for this national organization organizing war tax resistors, which people were sometimes worried about back then because, you know, there were things like COINTELPRO. There were things about the government infiltrating organizations, and there were laws that people talked about conspiring to overthrow the government and weird stuff like that. So anyway, it was kind of risky from some people's point of view. Anyway, I'm working for NUTRIC, and all of a sudden. And I'm talking with the IRS. I'm talking with the IRS in Smithtown, Long Island, New York, which is the area that I was living in. And I'm talking with a guy named Gerald Gubin, who is the IRS collection guy. And, you know, I don't know very much, but I'm talking to him. And, you know, in those days, you got to go in and actually talk to the IRS. You don't get to hardly do that anymore. But anyway, so. Me and my friends were carrying our signs into the Smithtown IRS and talking with Mr. Gubin, who, you know, told me he had immigrated to the U.S. from Russia, and he wanted me to know that things were better here than they were there, and I shouldn't be doing this. So I had a chance over a couple of years to talk with him and to tell him why I was doing what I'm doing. And then all of a sudden, the Justice Department, the federal marshals show up on my doorstep with a subpoena to federal district court in Brooklyn. Because I had, when Gerald had said to me, so tell me, Larry, where do you keep your money? And I said, Gerald, if I tell you where my money is, you're just going to take it. So why would I tell you that? And so Gerald passes it up the line. You know, he seems like a good guy, but he passes it up the line that I'm not going to tell him where my money is. And so all of a sudden, I'm being called into court. This was 1985. And, you know, so I go into court and I'm expecting to go to jail because, of course, I'm not going to tell him where my money is. I didn't tell him I didn't have any money, but, you know, I wasn't going to tell him that either. So they're looking for my money, and I say to the judge, I'm not going to tell you. And the judge says, Larry, don't do this. Why don't you think about this? He was a good judge. His name was Weinstein, and he was a federal district judge. I think he was even the chief justice at that time. The amazing thing is that Judge Weinstein just had his 98th birthday. And he's still a judge at the Brooklyn Federal District Court.
Wow.
And I wrote him a letter and I said, What do you remember about that 1985 situation? And he wrote me a letter back and said, Larry, I'm still a judge, so I can't comment on that. You know, I guess we're gonna have to wait for his tell all autobiography after he retires, but I think he's gonna be like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I suspect he's going to die on the bench. But, you know, so anyway, 1985, I'm standing there telling him I'm not going to cooperate. And he says, think about that. I'll give you a little time. So I go into court thinking I'm going to go to jail. And there's about 15 or 20 people sitting there, friends of mine, including my mom, who came from Michigan. And so we go out and have lunch at a Chinese place and see what happens. And lo and behold, how long was that later? So this was in January, and like 8 months later, the judge decides I win. The judge decides I don't need to tell the IRS where my money is, because I have a constitutional right, Fifth Amendment, not to incriminate myself. We didn't really like that reason, but we thought, okay. And, you know, there it is, you know. So the IRS didn't appeal, and that decision still stands, and it stood in good cause. The IRS now knows that, you know, it can't make people tell them where their assets are. And, you know, so it was a pretty surprising series of events. Got some publicity. I don't know what the end of that story is. I guess the end of that story is that I'm still going in. In fact, yesterday I went to the IRS office in Lynchburg. There is one here. Even in this little, well, we're not a little town, 85,000 people in central Virginia on the James River. I went in, saw Jeffrey Saunders. His name is Jeffrey. And Jeffrey, I've gone to see Jeffrey a few times. You know, I try to poke the bear occasionally because, you know, if you're going to resist taxes, if the IRS doesn't do anything, if the government doesn't do anything, what's the point? You know, you're trying to let them know you're a little annoyed with what they're doing. So if they just sit there with a blank stare, you think, what's happening here? So every once in a while, I go in and see Jeffrey, and he says, if you don't want to talk about taxes, blah, blah, blah. Don't, you know, he doesn't want it. He's very officious. He's not like Gerald back in Smithtown in the 1980s. He's not very friendly. So when he sees me coming, he, you know, he's got something else to do. So life goes on.
Well, so when you do file with the IRS,
I do file, and everybody who's a war tax resister doesn't file, but I do file.
Okay, so
and I do it honestly. I file the real stuff. And so, you know, I file. I get down to the bottom line. It says normally in recent years. I've been retired, so I haven't had enough income, so I didn't owe anything. But I file. I just don't pay.
You basically say, in the documentary, you say when you get to that last line, you just say, nope, not going to do that.
Nope, not going to do that. There's another good story. I got a million stories. Pete Seeger, everybody knows Pete Seeger, and everybody would have thought Pete Seeger would have been a war tax resister. Everybody remembers that Joan Baez was a war tax resister back during Vietnam. And in fact, I wrote Joan Baez a letter when I was organizing for another war tax resistance organization. And Joan wrote back, and basically she wrote back. This was something else that happened in the 1980s. I wrote to Joan, said, hey, you were a war tax resister. We're still doing this. She wrote me back a letter, sent a $500 check, and said, don't call me again. Joan got, I mean, you know, when you're rich and famous, you know, the IRS can make a lot of problems for you. And they made a lot of problems for people. You know, so Joan decided she couldn't be not collectible. She just had too many assets. But anyway, Pete Seeger, you would think, would be prime war tax resistance. But the story, and it is just a story. Who knows if it's an apocryphal story or not. But at least what he supposedly said was he and his wife filled out their income taxes. She would fill it out, and then she would cover up the top of the tax where it said what he owed, and he would just sign it. He didn't want to know. So, you know, that's the Pete Seeger story. So we're still kind of looking for, you know, there was a bishop out in the Northwest who was a supporter. I think his name was Bishop Hunthausen, who was, pretty well known and was a supporter of war tax resistance. There was another bishop, I think in the Midwest, his name was Gumbleton. He was supportive. You know, we're always looking for people who have, you know, the current, you know, I've been trying to get Michael Moore to say something about the pacifist because, you know, Michael Moore, you know, he's pretty well known and he's made a few movies that, and he gets a lot of attention. So, you know, if Michael Moore ever said, gee, you know, The Pacifist is a movie that you people ought to take a look at, that would be a big deal. But, you know, even though I met the guy at the bike shop down the road who says, you know, my ex-mother-in-law was friends of Michael Moore and still is in touch. And I'm saying, so can she talk to Michael Moore? So I'm still waiting for that shoe to drop. So,
well, I don't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to ask you, I wanted to ask you about things start to get really interesting and sort of take a unique turn with your story after your father passes away. You get an inheritance, and it's a pretty hefty inheritance. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, so of course, as I said, you know, my parents have always been really supportive of me. I think the film starts off with me saying that, you know, at my mother's memorial service, I said, you know, my mother's a criminal. You know, my mother went to jail a couple of times for civil disobedience, for crossing some imaginary line at a army base in Michigan or at a missile plant in Michigan. And so my parents were very supportive of me. My mother died about 10 years ago. My father died about 3 years ago.
And it's interesting because you were raised in your family were Republicans initially, but as you get into war tax resistance, your family becomes more open to the peace movement. Your parents become supportive of you. I just wanted to note that, but go on with your story.
Yeah, so you know, my parents really sea change happened, not exactly just, you know, it isn't an overnight thing, but in 1980, a guy named John Anderson, who was a Republican, ran for president as an independent. He was a pretty progressive Republican. Don't exist much anymore. But anyway, John Anderson ran for president in 1980, and my parents decide, having been at least, you know, Republicans on whatever the line was, you signed to be whatever you decide to be, that they were going to support John Anderson. And that was the beginning of their kind of coming out publicly as different than they had been. Then the court affair that I had in 1985 kind of really put them over the edge in the sense of saying, damn, you know, this is where we're at. We're behind our son. And we want to do what we can do, too. So they began organizing in the peace movement. They started an Episcopal Peace Fellowship organization at their church and joined a number of other peace and justice organizations, both as members and leaders. So my father dies 3 years ago, and he left me $1 million. Well, you know, so $1 million is a lot of money. I hadn't really expected that exactly, but, you know, I inherited some money and it was going to be taxable money. And the first thing that people say is, well, you know, taxable, you know, inheritance isn't taxable. You don't, you know, unless you inherit a lot of money, it's not taxable. Well, the sad story is that that's not true. The money that I inherited was taxable. And a lot of it I gave out to people who were my father's grandchildren and other significant people in his life that he wanted to leave money to. But he had said to me in his will, I want you to give this list of people these amounts of money, but I want you to give them the money so that it's not taxable. But the money that he left to do that was going to be taxable money, which meant I got the money and then I passed and was liable for the taxes. But then I gave it to these other people and, you know, they weren't liable for the taxes. So my father knew, I mean, he absolutely knew that, you know, that I was a war tax resister. And yet he directed this money through me to other people saying, don't let them be responsible for the taxes. So I give away to his friends and relatives about $500,000 of the $1 million. So that happened pretty quickly. But then there's still $500,000 left, which is, you know, a pretty good hunk of money. So in at least 2 years, 2016 and 2017, I had big, big tax liabilities because I took the money in two different batches in two different years. So I ended up owing about $250,000 in federal income taxes over that 2 years, which I didn't pay, which I haven't paid. In fact, yesterday when I went to see Jeffrey at the IRS, he gave me a little slip that said, you know, here's the total amount that you owe the IRS. And that total amount was like $289,700. And I got to say that Jeffrey knows where I'm coming from now, even though he doesn't want to talk to me about it. He didn't ask me if I was going to pay him any money yesterday when he gave me this. He just kind of handed me the paper and didn't say a word, which is kind of weird when somebody who's responsible for collecting almost $300,000 just hands you a piece of paper and doesn't even say boo. So anyway, now, and of course they're adding penalties and interest. So I owe the IRS about $300,000. But the important part, the amazing part for me is that in the last 3 years, I have donated to lots of organizations, charitable organizations, mostly tax deductible charitable organizations, well over $250,000. So the part about me as a war tax resister is that I don't benefit financially from not paying my taxes. I don't keep the money. I donate it to make the world a better place. Instead of giving it to
these aren't when you give the money to the charities, that's not like a tax deduction. You're taking that money and giving it directly to them, right? Or am I confused on that? Okay.
Yeah. Well, it is a tax deduction. Yeah. No. I mean, all of them aren't tax deductible organizations, but they are tax deductions. So they do lower my tax liability, which is a good thing. My goal is not to owe the United States a whole lot of money, but you know, the fact is I do. I go with that. But these are all, most all, legitimate charitable deductions. I do claim them on my income tax when I file my taxes. I claim those deductions, and that's what it'll say. It'll say, my record will show, and I have the receipts to show that I've donated, more than $250,000 to good causes, rather than give the money to the government.
Well, maybe going back to family for a second here.
Sure.
Do you think it was a matter of maybe, you know, people often say that the child learns from the parents, or they end up taking their parents' politics. It sounds like it was the opposite. The parents learned from you in a lot of ways.
There was definitely some of that. There was definitely some of that. I'd have to say, when I think back, you know, I think my mom was always more liberal than my father politically. But she was also a person who lived in that era where women were the secondary role. And she didn't really accept that. But, you know, that she was immersed in that era, in that situation. I remember my mom, when we moved into this suburban neighborhood, which was, you know, a neighborhood in Royal Oak that got built up after, you know, it was sort of the post-war baby boom neighborhood. We moved into a new house. In a neighborhood of new houses, and we looked for a church, or my dad looked for a church, and there was one a couple of blocks away. So we went to that church. It was a Lutheran church, and just because it was closest. And my mom went. But then when she found out that in this particular church, you know, when they had a meeting, women didn't get to vote. You know, it was just the men that voted. My mom said, "Sayonara, see you around." And she stayed at home on Sunday while me and my dad and my sister went off to church and did the church thing. And my mom stayed home and listened to the Episcopal Church, which was her heritage, on the radio. So my parents were, they changed, you know. I'm not sure they ever got, you know, I would call myself, I've always been a third party person, but, you know, my mom was always kind of the one who was always nudging my dad to do the right thing. He was willing to do that. He was also a person who would help a person who was down on their luck. You know, I can think of lots of instances where they did that together. And my father was certainly a part of that. But I always thought my mother was kind of the one who was the courage, the one who was, you know, who was pushing to kind of go beyond what might be the comfort level. And she did that for their entire married life, which was 60 plus years. And then when she died, my father was on his own, and he had to decide, you know, do I still do it Luella's way, my mom? And he did, you know, so he continued. She made him a better person, and he was a good person, and she was a good person. And so, yeah, you know, I think they were good people. And I just showed them that there were some possibilities, and they accepted that. My mom went to jail twice. I've never managed. It's still on my bucket list. Haven't been to jail. But my mom went to jail twice, and it was tough. It was tough. She was a grandma. She missed my second son's wedding because she was in jail, and they wouldn't give her leave to come out and go to the wedding. So we have the wedding pictures, you know, with no grandma, but she was in jail. And the second time she was in jail for 2 months. And it was a pretty long time. And she also learned who was in jail. You know, she learned that, you know, she was in jail with mostly poor Black women. So the problem with the system is when they put peace people in jail, then peace people find out that system is rotten. So they just create more organizers against the jail system. my daughter went to school of social work and in New York City.
I wanted to ask about your daughter. She's a very touching part of the documentary.
I have two grown sons from my first marriage. The first son who was born, who kept me out of the draft, who actually turns out to be my most conservative child, who is, you know, basically part of the military industrial complex. He works for a company that does defense work. He's not too wild about what I'm doing. And initially he thought I was going to mess up his security clearance because I was a bad guy. And it turned out I didn't do that, I guess. But Sean is still pretty annoyed with what I've done. And Anna is my first daughter in another marriage. And Anna is my daughter that's going to change the world. She actually has spent a year in Cambodia working at an orphanage. She spent a year in Sri Lanka on a post-college fellowship. She spent a year in Africa. She lived in places where there have been incredible humanitarian tragedies. And I thought she was going to end up working in international conflict resolution kinds of things. But she has ended up working with people who have serious mental disabilities and is in New York City and loving her work. But, you know, she's got the urge to make the world a better place. I have a younger daughter.
I wanted to say that the part of the documentary that just I was blown away by it was, you mentioned your daughter is in international relations, and then was going to be in international conflict resolution, and then it cuts to you talking with your daughter, and you mentioned that she's in social work now, and she's interested in things like prison reform or prison abolition. And I was just, that was such a nice moment in the film. I'm like, the daughter is taking after her her papa, and you know, it's cool that there's a sort of legacy being continued of working for peace and what is right.
Yeah, Anna is definitely a heartwarming daughter for me. She doesn't, you know, she's not a war tax resister. I'm not sure she'll ever be a war tax resister. It is interesting to see how, you know, the variations on a theme. But you know, she, like I say in the film, she's my kid that's going to change the world. My younger daughter is 16 and is adopted. She was abandoned as a child in China. And she was not abandoned like, she's kind of in that era of China where girl babies were, with the one child rules over there at that time, where girl babies were adopted at birth, were abandoned at birth. And it got to be a fairly notorious story internationally.
Yeah, because most Chinese parents, due to the one child policy, for my listeners that are unfamiliar, they would always want a boy to help with stuff at home, farm, all that stuff. So if they had a girl, they would just abandon the child. But go on, explain the story a little bit.
Yeah, so that's part of the history of that time. But my daughter was actually abandoned when she was several months old, which was well beyond the time. I mean, like I said, if somebody had a girl and they weren't intending to have a girl, that kid just got dumped, that girl child. So in the international adoption movement, there were a lot of Chinese girls on the market. Catherine, my daughter, whose name was Fu Ping, in China, that was her orphanage name. was abandoned at being several months old. So she was not abandoned because she was a girl. She was abandoned, we think. We don't, I mean, this is obviously, you know, thinking about what was going on. She had a cleft palate and cleft lip. So she couldn't nurse. She couldn't suck because of the her disability. So she couldn't nurse. She was starving. And her mother or her parents said, okay, we have this child who's going to die because she has a problem and we can't nourish her. And we've tried, but we're failing. What can we do? So what they did was they abandoned her, you know, on the steps, we understand, of a police department where she would be immediately found and they hoped taken care of. And she was. They fixed the cleft lip and she lived in orphanages and then in foster homes in 3.5 years, for 3.5 years in China, in far, far Western China. Before we found her online and adopted her. But that's the kind of, you know, to me, that's the kind of experience where you would think, you know, there's not enough, there's plenty of resources. That shouldn't have to happen in the world, but it does. And one of the reasons I would say that that happened is because, you know, everybody's spending all of their resources on things that are not making the world a better place. So we have a healthy, happy 16-year-old adopted daughter from China who is now pretty Americanized, but healthy, happy, bright, in spite of the fact that she had a pretty difficult first 3 years of her life. It's her story, and it'll be interesting to see what she will make of that in the future. She, you know, will hopefully someday want to learn something about what happened back there in Aksu, China. But so far, she's just growing up in the U.S.
Well, that's another heartwarming story. In addition to being the pacifist, I would also call you the humanist, which we need more of them these days.
I am a humanist. I would call I knew the word humanist. I would go for humanist. I'm not a very good pacifist. You know, I talk about nonviolence. I'm kind of I'm not an intellectual pacifist. I haven't studied the books. I haven't read all the theories. You know, it's just kind of, you know, humanist. Yes, definitely. And giving away $250,000 has just been a total trip. I mean, talk about a good time. You know, you learn how difficult it is to be a philanthropist. I gave a little bit of my money to actually directly to people in Uganda, to an orphanage in Kenya, to regular poor people, to somebody in Haiti, people who I met on Facebook, ironically enough. There's a whole subculture on Facebook of people begging for money from people in other parts of the world. And so, of course, there's a lot of duplicity, a lot of people saying untrue things. But, you know, I got to know a few people and got to believe that I wasn't being scammed, and tried to do things to help them improve their situation. And it's been a pretty amazing and pretty distressing experience.
So go on. I'm sorry.
No, just because when you're dealing with real people who are experiencing poverty that we can't even begin to understand in the United States, it's tough. And, you know, it makes people do pretty discouraging things sometimes because they don't know what else to do. And, you know, you're the guy that lives in the country with the golden with the, you know, the gold streets.
Well, in that regard, I was going to ask, and I'd like to say I really agree with your point there. I think, you know, people in poverty, you know, people say, oh, well, people that are poor commit more crimes. And I'm like, well, people, when they're desperate, will commit more crimes. And I think that's a sad thing. And I think we should make sure that people aren't living in poverty. But something I wanted to ask you was, did you take any of that money? I mean, most people, if they had $1 million in inheritance, they would spend it on, you know, parties, or they would want to, you know, go out and impress some girls. It seems like you had no interest in any of that.
Well, you know, I have had not a lot of income in my life because I've worked in human services. So I never had a lot of money, but I've always been comfortable. You know, I've never suffered from lack of something. You know, you can't have everything, but you know, you can make your choices. You can pick your spots. And so, you know, I've had a pretty easy life, and I've had some pretty good luck. When I've needed help, I've had help available. I did one thing for myself. I found a place in town that is kind of like a life care place, you know, so that I live in a loft in a building on the James River in Lynchburg, in an old building that used to be a shoe warehouse and now is a combination condominium and arts building. And, you know, so I figured, well, you know, I have parents who lived into their 90s. So, you know, maybe I'll get old and won't be able to take care of myself. So I kind of put a deposit on this place where I can move when I can't take care of myself someday, if that happens. So that was good. I did that for myself. And, you know, I also have been able to help my first daughter, Anna, with some college expenses, and I have put aside some money to be able to help Catherine with future college expenses. So I did those things for myself. But, you know, I don't need much else in my life. I have a comfortable place to live. I like looking out my windows at the river. You know, I have enough to eat, and I've been able to help some people very directly and some people indirectly through organizations. As a result of this big windfall from my father and the war tax resistance that followed that, you know, the local paper did a story about me a couple of years ago, which was kind of fun because the guy that wrote the story said he'd been waiting for a story to come along where he could talk about Alice's restaurant, and Alice's restaurant is part of my story. So he was happy, and he made that a part of the local newspaper story. So I got a little local notoriety. And you know, this guy in town who makes movies saw the article in the paper, and Alex called me up and said, let's talk. And the pacifist resulted from that. And another guy who's an artist who I had actually bought some art from.
You're
called
very
me up
involved
and
with the art world. I want to mention
very,
that for my listeners.
Yeah, I'm getting to that. So this artist who I had a couple of pieces by called me up and said, hey, that picture in the newspaper was pretty cool. I'd like to paint that picture. So he did. So I have this portrait of myself. Now, I don't know what you do with a portrait of yourself, but anyway, I have one. So, you know, I have a portrait of myself painted from the photograph in the newspaper. So I got a film made about me. I got a picture painted about me. And now I have this group of kids in an orphanage in Uganda who are singing songs about me in an African dialect plus English. And I just gave them a little bit of money. I don't really have much money left over, but anyway, I still have enough. So I gave them some money, this group in Uganda, and they're recording songs, which they say are going to be a big hit. So I'm going to have songs written about me. I live in this building, which is filled with art, and I have been for a long time, and none of my tax money went to buy art, but I have bought a lot of art since I've lived here, which has been about 16 years. I moved into this building filled with artists, and I am not an artist. And I said, what can I do for artists? I'm not an artist. And I said, oh, well, artists like to sell their stuff. So I started buying some local art. It's my addiction. I tried a few other things and I never could get addicted to anything, but I did get addicted to buying local art. So I now have about 200 plus pieces of local art of various persuasions, mostly big, bold, and abstract is what is my favorite. But I've bought all this art, and of course I have some pretty big walls in my loft, so I have some in my house, but I also have a pretty big hallway, so I filled up my hallway, and then I thought, what can I do now? And then the people who have the gallery in the building, the Arts Riverviews, said, hey, Larry, could we show your local art collection in the gallery? So a couple of years ago, they put about 60 or 70 of the pieces at that time of my local art collection in the gallery for 6 or 8 weeks, and people from all over town came and looked at it, and it was pretty amazing. It looked pretty good. And then they said, hey, I said to the director of the arts organization, I said, this is wonderful, because usually my art is up on the sixth floor where, you know, it's kind of restricted access, so nobody get to see it. So she said, hey, why don't we find a way to get some of this art out into the community? And I said, well, hey, I'm a pretty big supporter of human service organizations. Why don't we check some of these organizations that I make donations to and put some of this art out in these, you know, like the soup kitchen and the, lots of different human service organizations in town. So now I have art from my collection out in 8 different human service organizations around town. And I'm talking with, there's 2 high schools in town, and one has a history of having local art in the hallways, but the new high school doesn't. So I said, hey, maybe I could give Heritage my collection so that, you know, when I die in 20 years, my collection can be carried on by the second local high school. So they're going to take my collection and continue to curate the art out in the local human service organizations. And I get to keep some here as long as I still live here. So it's like a win-win-win. So only good things are happening. And today I'm 73, 73rd birthday today. Happy birthday to me. Talking on the phone here to you is my birthday present. But I also have all this terrific art, and people get to see it, and I get to see it, and the curators from the art organization change out the art at different places. And so every once in a while, I wake up in the morning and I look out in the hall, and there are a few empty spots in the hall where they've taken some art. And then later in the afternoon, they come back and hang up the stuff that was out in whatever location they're switching out the art. And when I go to my doctor's office, which is one of the places where the art is in a community health organization, there's my art on the wall, and people know me because there's my picture on the wall too. And they say, are you the guy with the art? And I say, yeah. And they say, we love it. And I think, you know, what can I say? And all of this is from refusing to pay for killing. But only good things have happened. Only good things have happened. But I'm waiting for the IRS to come and jump on me. And I, like I said, I hope they do, but you know, good luck to you guys.
Well, I was going to say that, I mean, it's really heartwarming to hear, you know, that maybe this art is getting out to places in the community where you know, people are getting exposed to art that they would have never seen otherwise. I mean, it's really heartwarming what you've done with all this money because, you know, it reminds me of the saying, you know, you can have all these vices, you know, whether it's sex or drugs or, you know, whatever. But the biggest reward of them all is helping others and helping each other.
You know, I have just, you know, and I get so excited thinking about all the possibilities. And, you know, I think is the word septuagenarian. My septuagenarian years, my 70s, I think are going to be pretty phenomenal. They've started off really well, in spite of the fact that, you know, they started with my dad dying, which was pretty rough to take. So, you know, I have a family of origin of mom, dad, sister, me, four people. And I have pictures of the four of us on my wall. So, you know, my sister was the first to die, which was pretty traumatic. She died in her early 60s of pancreatic cancer. So that was a big blow. And it totally took down my mother. My mother died pretty quickly after my sister died. It just broke her heart. So my sister and mom died pretty close together. And then my dad died just recently. But, you know, he was 95. He had a good life. You know, he had called me from the place he lived in an assisted living facility in Michigan, where he lived for the last 5 years by his own choice. You know, he called me up and said, "Larry, it's time to turn the page." You know, he knew he was coming to the end. And he was ready for it. And he left me with one of the bigger adventures of my life, which is what can you do when you're a millionaire? So, you know, I can check that off my list. It never was really on my list, whoever thinks they're going to be a millionaire, but you know, so I've done that. I'm not a millionaire anymore. I'm back to my normal retirement income, which is, you know, a little bit of Social Security, a little bit of disability from the state of Virginia. And that's it. But, you know, I have a place to live. And, you know, I have a lot of good things in my life. So
it's really great to me because I think, like I said, you know, there's plenty of people with money that I know that are miserable people. But you're one of the happiest people I've ever met.
Well, you know, I'm happy talking about, I try to look on the upside. You know, I have a lot of upside to look at. I just hope somehow, you know, I think Alex, who did the film, is just a super talented filmmaker. That isn't what he does for a living. This is his hobby, you know, and he put his heart and soul into making The Pacifist. And he's good at what he does in real life. He's actually won, I hope Alex won't mind me saying this, he's actually won two regional Emmys for sound production the last 2 years for his day job. And but he made this film because he saw the story, we talked, and he wanted to share it. And, you know, it's been such an incredible experience. And yeah, it's an ego trip. Of course it's an ego trip. And people, you know, you alluded to it earlier, I think. You know, a lot of people think, they don't really like people who blow their own horn, who crow about their own good things. And a lot of people don't like that I do that. Alex doesn't like it. He would, you know, he lets me do it because he knows I have a lot of good times doing it. But Alex is not that kind of a guy. He likes to be kind of low key. I just feel so pleased that people get to see this film. And I just wish more people would see it. And it's tough because We don't, you know, we have gotten into a few film festivals, but I can't tell you how many we tried to get into. You know, you only say, you know, like we won awards in these dozen places, but, you know, we're not telling you about, you know, the 200 other places that said, see you around. And, you know, we're still hoping, you know, that we got a couple of more of those, to go. Because everybody says when you say, you know, they say, oh, you're going to be in Sundance? Well, you know, that's the only film festival that most people in the world have ever heard about. And no, we didn't go to Sundance and never will. But this is the story of small budget filmmaking. But when people see the film, they are impressed with how well it is done. It is produced very nicely.
It's beautifully shot. I mean, it's a beautiful film.
It is a beautiful film, and it's not because of all the of everything that went into it. You know, 70% of the film is shot right here in my living room. You know, and a lot of the film is, I don't want to say it's all just talking heads, but you know, a lot of it is. It's just me. And we didn't have a script. I mean, I just sat and talked. And mostly that's what the film is. And then Alex amazingly took all these hours of shooting and made it into 57 minutes that are pretty interesting, And I don't know, some people, I think, are kind of put off by the title, The Pacifist, because they think, oh, well, you know, I don't want to be a pacifist, or what's that got to do with me? But, you know, it's really just a story about one person and about what one person tried to do about a pretty big issue. And hopefully it encourages people to think about what one person can do. Because that's really all most of us ever get to do in our lives is be one person. And, you know, all the stories about, you know, the one snowflake, the one grain of sand, the one drop of water. Well, you know, so all those stories apply, and good and bad.
Well, I just want to ask you one more question, and I've been avoiding it because I know you get asked this by – whenever people ask you about your life, they probably find out you're a war tax resister, and, you know, some people are like, ooh, or they walk away. They don't know what to say, and the question that I'm assuming you always get is, aren't you afraid that the IRS is going to come after you? And, I mean, I would assume that the IRS doing something is a possibility, but – How do you sort of respond to that? That's the million-dollar question a lot of people, I think, would have after listening to this.
Right. Well, I think that I think, number one, if the IRS was ever going to come after somebody, I would be that somebody. And they did come after me once. They come after me once. And, you know, part of the story was when people ask me about being brave, I can still remember when the federal marshals started showing up at my house lived in East Patchogue, Long Island, New York. And they would come up. We called it the Pizza Hut house because it was red and it had kind of a dome on the top. Anyway, the federal marshals are coming to serve me with a subpoena, and they were so untrained at it that they thought they had to give the subpoena to me personally. Well, it turned out they didn't. They just had to actually leave it in the door and, you know, say that they left it at my last known address. But anyway, they were trying to serve it on me. So they were knocking on the door. The way the house was laid out, there was a little kind of opaque glass along the edge of the front door. So it wasn't like you could see through it, but you could see you could see through it a little bit, and it looked into where the kitchen was. And while they were knocking on the door, I was hiding behind the refrigerator because I thought, oh shit, I don't want them to catch me. I wasn't feeling so brave right then. And yet, you know, here I am now with, you know, with a big debt. I mean, certainly from for most people, owing $300,000 to the federal government would seem like they would do something. And what I try to remind people is, number one, they probably won't ever have to owe $300,000. But, you know, the thing about war tax resistance, it's totally up to the person doing it. You can withhold $10.40, or you can withhold 10%, or you can withhold, you know, whatever symbolic amount you want to make. Of course, the important thing is that because for most people it comes out of their paycheck, they have to make their withholding so that they owe something. Most people think, well, you know, they get a refund and isn't that terrific? Well, you know, you have to remind people, of course, that, you know, this is all talking about big federal bucks. So if you want to resist, you got to owe something. But there are plenty of people who also resist by earning less than a taxable income intentionally. You know, you don't hear about those people. So there are lots of things to do. And the important thing about the IRS is what they really want is the money. They don't really want to harm you or put you in jail. I mean, that's a lot of work. They don't really want to take your house. They've done that a couple of times for people, and it's just grief for them.
Well, you've I think you've actually had an IRS agent or two that have actually said, "I can't take this case because they like you." Yeah.
I mentioned Mr. Gubin because he was the guy who I talked to in Smithtown a number of times. And the last time I saw Mr. Gubin, we knew I was going to court. And he was actually involved in that, at least as part of the system. But the last thing Mr. Gubin ever said to me, the last time I saw him, was, "I'm rooting for you." So, you know, he knew what I was all about. We had shared some human experience. Another experience that I had back during that same time was I went with my partner to a meeting to talk about war tax resistance. And afterwards, a woman came up and said, "You know, my husband's an IRS collection officer, and he was assigned your case, and he asked to be taken off that case because he didn't feel like he could morally do his job in that situation." So, you know, that's the kind of feedback you get from real people. That's kind of what I'm hoping I could get from Jeffrey Saunders, the IRS guy here in Lynchburg, but I don't think he's approachable. You know, he's just going to do his job, but, you know, I'm still willing to be surprised. So I try to personalize this. I try to let people know who I am, that I'm not a bad guy. And I'm trying to do what I think is right. And I am taking some risk. There's no doubt that I know that I'm taking some risk. But at this point, I know that, at least I think I know, that there's no way they're going to ever collect $300,000 from me. I haven't got $300,000. Everything I own put together isn't even vaguely like $300,000. So I'm just waiting for the 10 years to go by. They have 10 years to collect. So, you know, they're going to click off that 10 years, and they're not going to have their $300,000. What they're getting right now is something around $50 or $60 a month out of my Social Security. And they'll continue to get that because that's easy. That's a piece of cake. If I ever had a tax refund, they would take that. But I'm not ever going to have a tax refund. And, you know, other than that, they're, you know, and they filed a lien. They filed even a public lien, which is, you know, the IRS doesn't have to file a lien to seize your property. They can just do that. But they actually filed a public lien, which means that it's on the record. You know, it means that if you try to sell your house or sell something that had to go through some legal process, that, you know, it would run into trouble. Or if you maybe tried to get a bank loan, it might run into trouble. But, you know, I'm not going to do any of those things in the foreseeable future. So there's no way they're going to collect any money from me. So people are afraid because the IRS has done an incredibly good job of convincing anybody that, you know, they're just so powerful. Mostly the information they have is the information, you know, that's on your tax return, because people know that when they file their return, if they file an itemized return, you know, they put down or you know, they get notices from their bank that says how much interest they got, and that shows up. So the IRS has access to that kind of information. So, you know, so I have to mess around with bank accounts and things like that to be sure that there aren't any obvious things. So because, you know, it isn't like the old days. When I lived in Bellport, Long Island, back in the 80s, they came to town, and there were three banks in town, and they were looking for my money, and they went to two of the banks, but they didn't go to the bank where I had my money. So how can you explain that kind of weirdness? But, you know, they don't do that anymore. The IRS doesn't have the resources to make any significant searches. When my dad died, he had overpaid his taxes, so they owed him some money after he died, and I was the next of kin anyway. So the IRS actually sent me a check for, I think it was like $7,000, which was pretty surprising. But, you know, they didn't have any way to say, oh, this is the guy that, you know, at that point owes us $100,000. So, you know, they were just, they're just a bureaucracy. The right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. So, yeah, I could be afraid of them. But, you know, I just choose not to be. Partly it's because I've had enough dealings with them that I kind of know what the routine is. And, you know, even though I try to have a more significant conversation with Mr. Saunders here at the local IRS office, I can just say, well, you know, yesterday he was happy because he could help me with my problem. My problem was that I still hadn't heard from them about my 2018 taxes. But, you know, so he was able to find out what was going on and solve that problem. And he felt, I could tell by the way he talked to me, that he felt positive about having done his job. And he didn't have to listen to me, even though when I walked out the door, I said, now remember, Jeffrey, you know, watch The Pacifist and you'll understand a little bit more. He doesn't want to talk to me about The Pacifist, but he was glad he could help me. So there's still a little humanity back there lurking, in spite of the fact that he would like to kind of be gruff and growl at me.
Do any family members worry about the IRS, or are they also sort of your viewpoint?
I think, you know, my daughter Anna in the film says she worries a little bit, but I think at this point everybody sort of knows that I'm just kind of in my normal mode of action. So I don't feel like, and you know, if they really started to do something, you know, I think the thing that I think about is, you know, as far as I know, as far as I'm aware of, I don't know through anybody in, I don't know any other war tax resisters. I mean, I know lots of them nationally around different places, but, you know, I don't have anybody in my family who's ever said, you know, maybe I should do something like that. You know, my parents, no, you know, even though I was a war tax resister for a lot of years when they were alive, they didn't, as far as I know, consider doing anything like that. We never talked about it anyway, and they obviously never did it. So, you know, I just continue to be mystified by even the people in town who I know, even the artists, who, you know, are sympathetic to my position, never say, makes me think about doing something like that. I just don't know. Whatever it is that keeps people from taking some action, just it's the mystery of my life.
I always like to say that I want to end the show on a positive note. I think this has been a pretty positive, upbeat show. But if there's any parting positive vibes you can give out to my audience, I have a lot of younger listeners, and I hope they'll be inspired by your story.
Yeah, no, I mean, we keep looking. Of course, the whole peace movement is looking for young people to, you know, to step up and do something. You know, you go to meetings and, you know, there's all these people with white hair, and I'm one of them. So, you know, we're always looking for people who are starting out in life and thinking. And actually, I remember, again, back in the last century, back when I began being a war tax resister, it was, you know, it was looking for people who were young. It was easier for people when they were younger, to be war tax resisters because they didn't have anything. They didn't have any assets. The problem that we found with people is that when they got a little older and they started to have stuff, they kind of started to worry about, well, maybe, you know, maybe they were putting it at some risk. So it always seemed like people who were younger both were a little bit more radical in their political thinking and a little bit more willing to take the risk. So, you know, I continue to think that people just feel like the military spending budget numbers are just so huge, people can't even begin to see how they have any impact on that. And I just have to say that I have really come to the belief that first, you know, it is that old truth about how, you know, you may not be able to change the system, but you don't want to have the system change you. So you still want to be true to your values. And, you know, how you use your resources is one of the ways that you show what your values are. And that, you know, being a tax redirector, taking taxes away from something that you don't want to support and putting it towards something that you do want to support is a pretty empowering experience. It feels good. And, you know, you just need to pick an amount to resist that feels significant to you. You know, whether that is, you know, some people used to say, well, you know, if 50% of the budget is going to the military, then I will refuse to pay 50% of my taxes. You know, so that might be a pretty big number for somebody, in a sort of normal middle class income range. It might even just be something like a couple of $100s where you could actually not only refuse to pay a small amount, but when you give it to somebody, to some organization, you could tell them, this is where this money is coming from. And that's part of the conversation, is being able to tell people, this is why I am able to make this contribution. And of course, when I was making contributions after inheriting this large amount of money, I was making quite a few $1,000 contributions. And when you give $1,000 to a local organization in your own hometown, people notice. You know, you have to tell them, you know, I'm probably not going to be able to do this again next year or the year after because I'm not going to have this money anymore. But people notice $1,000 because organizations, you know, are struggling. And lots of organizations that do really good things are struggling, especially these days. So you have a lot of opportunities beyond just resisting to be able to kind of let people know. So it is, you know, it's the grain of sand. It's the one snowflake. It's the one drop in the ocean. But, you know, you got to do it. I hope.
Have you ever... And I know I keep asking you more questions when I said we'd wrap up, but I have to ask this because it just popped in my head and, it, you know, moment of inspiration, I guess. But have you ever wondered, let's say 5% of the population, 10% of the population, 20% of the population, all of us. What if we just did what you did? And when we look at these wars and we see how much money, how much our taxes go into the wars, what if we just said no? Have you ever imagined what that would be like if more of us did that?
I have imagined it lots of times, and I hope other people are imagining it. But this won't be a down, but it is a little bit of a down. The first peace organization I ever worked for, after I stopped being, at that point I left this small Virginia town in the mountains from being a social worker and moved up to Long Island to work for an organization called the Conscience and Military Tax Campaign, CMTC. Doesn't exist anymore. But it was an organization that was dedicated to collecting 100,000 signatures of people who said, when there are 100,000 people signed up, we will all collectively resist taxes to become a war tax resister in order to encourage the Congress to pass what at that time was called the World Peace Tax Fund. Ron Dellums, a group of Quakers in Ann Arbor, initiated an idea called the Peace Tax Fund in the early 1970s, and it's been introduced in Congress ever since then, every term, to try to make it so that people could be conscientious objectors to paying war taxes, so that when those people paid their taxes, it would be directed into a separate fund that wouldn't go to the military. Long story, but still going on. And so, you know, the CMTC was an effort to get 100,000 people to say, we will do this together. Well, the CMTC went for about 8 or 10 years. It had a pretty large alternative fund, which was a fund of money that people who had resisted put into the fund to keep it safe and away from the IRS. But it went out of business, and it went out of business with 10,000 signatures, which ironically is the number of resistors that the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee says there are 10,000 war tax resistors in the United States. They've been saying that for since their existence. So who knows? We're not countable. But you know, so the CMTC tried this, you know, let's get all these little grains of sand together. And they got 10,000 out of 100,000. Now, the thing that I found working for that organization for a number of years was that once people had the courage or whatever it took to sign that petition, many of those people didn't wait for the next 99,999 people to come along. They started because they had gotten past whatever that barrier was of, I can't do this. They signed something committing themselves to doing that in the future, but they couldn't wait. Once they had the idea in their head, they couldn't wait. They had to do something. So they did, a lot of them. That's, you know, so there we are. You know, what if enough people did this to really make a difference? Now, you know, you don't know what does $1 trillion a year on war look like? Wow. You can't even imagine. You know, would that cover the state of Delaware 12 feet deep? I don't, you know, it's just like, how can you have an impact on that? So that's kind of a downer to think about, but of course, I mean, the power of the people, power to the people. We are the ones who pay for this. We are the ones who pay for this. And if somebody came to your door and said, I'm collecting money to kill people, you know, I mean, you wouldn't say, well, Would you take a check? You wouldn't. You would shut the door. That simple.
Well, you know, I want to thank you again, Larry Bassett, for coming on Parallax Views. And I just want to say this in closing. We live in pretty dark times. I mean, we're talking about war internationally. I mean, right now we have a war at home with militarization of the police, these ICE detention centers. I mean, it's dark times we live in. But what worries me a lot about our cultural moment is I notice a lot of people drifting into sort of misanthropy, a sort of dislike of other people. And to me, that's not a good thing. I think, though, that people like you and your story remind us that people aren't bad. The people, we the people, are the good guys, you know. And
yeah.
If we want, we can make change happen. You know, people aren't bad. The misanthropes are right. Going to lose out, and I think good will win out at the end of the day. I know people say that's naive, but I believe it.
Yeah. Well, the pacifist starts out with some photographs of dead children killed in war. And it ends with a challenge to the IRS of, you know where this guy lives. He's waiting for you. Come and get him. And, you know, horrible things are happening, but what are you going to do if you don't try to make that be different? You got to work at it, and you have to hope that whatever you do will make a difference. And I believe that, because what else can I believe?
There's always hope.
There, absolutely. Got to hang on to that. And having this conversation is part of my hope. And now I'm going to go. And, you know, I'm being flooded with happy birthday on Facebook because it is my birthday today. So I'm going to go. And that's going to be a lot of pats on the back from lots of people. And a few of them are going to know what I'm trying to do. And they're going to say, thank you for what you're doing. So I want to say to everybody out there, thank you for what you're doing, not only yesterday, but what you can still do tomorrow, because we all have tomorrow. And we don't have to do whatever we thought we were going to do someday. Tomorrow is someday.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with War Tax Resister Larry Bassett, and I would highly recommend checking out Alex Zort's documentary on his life and times entitled The Pacifist. It's a really thrilling, independently produced, and just extremely touching documentary about a man of peace and protest. If you enjoy the conversations I've been putting out through Parallax Views, please consider supporting us on Patreon. $5 a month and you will get exclusive bonus content like the Parallax Views After Hours program and the new current events podcast, Parallax Views The Week That Was. Of course, if you are unable to become a patron to Parallax Views, you could always just get the word out there on social media, Facebook, Twitter, retweet, like, share, get the word out there about Parallax Views. That's another way you can help grow the program. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax View, to Parallax View, with Parallax View.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I'm
I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.